Welcome to this semester's lecture series on stellar dynamics. I'll begin by introducing myself and then tell you a little bit of the technical details of what this lecture series is going to be about, what I expect to do, what I expect you to do, and how it connects with the other courses that are being taught at Leiden Observatory. The level of this course is what you might call an initial master's level. That is to say, I will take your bachelor's knowledge for granted, but this is not yet on the level of, let us say, your major master's thesis project. It fits with the rest of the observatory to the extent that there is a parallel series of lectures given by Professor Simon Portugies-Zwart that focuses much more on the computational side of astrophysics and the computational side of stellar dynamics. So basically what we will be doing here is considering the theory. And you will notice, even today, that I will pay relatively scant attention to observations. There are very good reasons for this. One is that I am by no means sufficiently knowledgeable in the field, and the second is that you have to focus somehow. One might then think that stellar dynamics is going to be a simple course in applied classical mechanics, and I will try to persuade you in the course of the semester that this is not at all the case, that in fact, not only does this lecture series have parallels with computational stellar dynamics, but also it has parallels in basically all of astrophysics. And I will tell you a little bit later what my aim is in what I'm trying to achieve in this lecture series. The form of this lecture series, then, is going to be primarily explanation. That is to say, I will do some talking here. I'll tell you in a moment about what textbook we will use and how we will use it. And that, of course, means that it is going to be a little bit floating. But it is not really, I'm not going to be reading from a book, as it were. Right? There's totally no reason for doing this. You can read perfectly well. In fact, you can read better yourself. And for the rest, if there is supporting material, I will point you to various sites in the web where you can find it yourself. So what I aim for in this lecture series is what you might call understanding. Now, that's a big word. It is my considered opinion that science is not about knowledge. Science is about understanding. And this is what I'm trying to get through to you. This being said, that means that a big part of the course, is going to be relatively verbal from my point of view, and verbal, I hope, also from your point of view. I should very much appreciate it if you were to participate in the course to the extent that if you have any remarks whatsoever, because I'm not clear, or because I said something wrong, or because you have heard something different, or because you have an opinion in the matter, or if you're working on this, please do say so. Right, so do participate. After all, this is a course in science and not a course in politics, so it is supposed to be about facts and about what we can find about facts together. Having said that, this is going to be a sort of more or less talkative type lecture series where I try to explain the background and the construction of various forms of theory that we have in stellar dynamics. There is definitely a need for continuing that conversation. And that is why I am so fortunate to have a teaching assistant, who is Mattia Fomagalli, sitting over there. He is one of our graduate students in the observatory. And we will discuss in a moment what time you would prefer for the TA sessions. Right now, what TA sessions can be absolutely anything. Right, for instance, you may have found something that you don't think will fit in the course, you may have found something that I've said wrong, you may be uncertain about certain things, or you may want to participate in some of the practical exercises that Mattia and I will be setting for you. Right? And all these will be at the TA hour at a time to be decided today. Feedback is a very important ingredient in science and a very important ingredient in teaching. And that is why Mattia will be participating in the course to help you along with this. Also, in some cases, and I will present some examples this morning, a quantitative elaboration of what I'm going to show you here is of importance. You will notice that in this lecture series in general, I will pay a lot of attention to the structure of the dynamics, the structure of the equations, why things were built a certain way and what they do. That is to say, you will get, either in my notes or on the blackboard, symbols rather than numbers. And this is not necessarily very good. You'll see the relationship between various things, but you don't see how big they are. And this is why in the TAR, every now and then I will ask you to work out some quantitative examples of what it is that we will be talking about. Also, but this will develop in the course of the semester, I will try to make certain that this course fits with Professor Portugis-Zwart's lecture series. Right? May I see a show of hands? Who wants to attend Portugis-Zwart's lectures?
One,
two. I'm so sorry.
I followed it last year.
Ah, okay. Then you might be bored by my lectures because actually the order is supposed to be the other way around. Sir?
I'm doing it at the moment.
You are? Okay. So it's just two of them? All right. Well, for the others, you do what you want to do. In order to support us, there is a textbook that I intend to use. It doesn't seem that I've brought it now. That is my omission. It's called Galactic Dynamics. It's a book by Binney and Tremaine. I'll bring it to you after the break. Sorry, I thought I had it with me here. it's an excellent book. It's a sort of worldwide standard in stellar dynamics and in galactic dynamics. On the other hand, it is about 4 centimeters thick. And that is far too much for a one-semester lecture course on this level. What I intend to do is pick from the book those parts that pertain to stellar dynamics proper. There is a lot in the book about galactic structure, which is why it's called galactic dynamics. However, one of my aims in this particular series is to show you how stellar dynamics connects to other forms of astrophysics, such as structure formation in the early universe, cosmology, and stellar evolution. And I will try to tell you even today why it is that all these things are of importance, that a galaxy cannot be considered a separate island in the universe, but is connected with the universe as a whole. And we really must consider everything from birth to death in that case. So the specific chapters from Binney and Tremaine about galactic structure, and there's a lot of detail there, which is very beautiful, I will have to omit, because we don't really talk about galactic structure. We talk about stellar dynamics, which is only a subset thereof. As I've mentioned, the course format is going to be mostly geared towards explanation. That is, in words, and in some cases, I will just give you a skeleton, as it were, of the various equations. So I will be very sloppy with factors of 4 pi and pi over 3 and stuff of that general sort. They are in the book, but I really want you to understand, in the sense that you can reproduce it from memory, what the structure of the various equations is. It's not a reading, as I already mentioned, and I hope it will be not a monologue either, but that really depends on you. As to the prerequisites, what you will need for this, the one and only thing that you really cannot possibly do without is a solid knowledge of classical mechanics. Right? This is something that you just absolutely have to do. If you haven't, then brush up. Right? I will be leaning relatively heavily on classical mechanics, to a certain extent also on thermodynamics. And I hope that you have had, I'll do a census in a moment, you had at least some education in that. You will, from the mathematical point of view, need a relatively solid understanding of ordinary differential equations. I take it that this is sort of something that you have already achieved. But interestingly enough, and that is what I think makes part of this course so fascinating, you will also need everything else. You will need a basic knowledge of physics and astronomy in order to see how this particular subject is connected to all the other subjects that surround us in this research institute. Now, it is required for me to set an exam for this. Now, there is going to be a lot of change in that respect. We on the faculty over here have been bombarded in the last year and a half with literally hundreds of pages prescribing to us how we are to set exams. This is something that I find really rather extraordinary, but this is the way it is supposed to be. If we were to follow those guidelines literally, it would be completely out of the question to set any exam whatsoever, because it's always possible for anyone to cast doubt on the way things are being tested. In particular, when it is your aim, as it is my aim in this course, to test for understanding rather than for knowledge. If I wanted to test you for knowledge, I would just simply give you a blank sheet of paper and start reciting questions, and you just scribble the answers. And this is not something that I really like to do. It is not something the way the human mind works, and it is certainly not the way in which science works. We're in a science course here. How we're going to resolve that, I don't really know. Maybe I will do a census right at this point. It is my preference in this particular case, since we will be testing for understanding, to set a test in the form of an exam paper, something that you can just write yourself at home. If you read the guidelines, this is, of course, completely out of the question, because you can have your paper written by somebody else and then give it to me and say, there you are, professor. I trust it that no sane person will steal from himself. Okay, so this is something that I can completely forget about. Let me see a short show of hands. An oral exam, I think, is out of the question in the circumstances. So the choice is basically between a written exam and a term paper, right? Of those two, who would prefer a written exam? You can say yes to both questions, okay? Who would prefer a term paper? All right, so for the moment, we'll set it in the form of a term paper. If in the course of this particular series, the majority of you change his opinion, okay, I'm amenable to, I'm adaptable to this, all right? It's just simply a matter of making certain that you know that something is expected of you in the end. About the course materials, since there is this good book by Binion Termain, I will not typically hand out my own notes, right? I just relatively cursory, and it is really not necessary. Since in the book, the authors have been very precise about factors 4 pi over 3 and things like that. I'm sorry. Since the authors have been very precise about everything that really needs to be in the various equations, there's no need for me to do that all over again. What I will do, however, is I will probably put a PDF of my slides on my website, and I will certainly put an MP3 recordings of these lectures on my website. So those of you who may want to say, well, I didn't quite understand this in the first reading, you can listen to that again. It will be available on the web. It will, however, be available as is, right, including errors and coughs and stuff of that general sort. I'm not going to make a sort of super CD soundtrack for you. That is not really the aim. What is my aim, then? My overall aim with this lecture series is to provide you with understanding in the form of what you might call portable knowledge. Imagine that you are sitting in a colloquium and somebody is giving a research colloquium, a PhD colloquium, or something on stellar dynamics, or the origin of galaxies, or something of that general sort. Insofar as you are polite enough not to take your laptop computer to the colloquium and start looking things up on the web, you will just be sitting there, and you will have to understand from your own brain what is going on. In that brain is supposed to be the kind of knowledge that I'm trying to convey, something that a sense for how things hang together, a sense of proportion, a sense for numbers, right? Somebody says, well, you know, this galaxy is 10 to the 19 seconds old. You are supposed to understand that the universe is 10 to the 18 seconds old, and that, therefore, is a really bizarre remark. So it might seem a bit woolly to require of physics and astrophysics students to have, as it were, an intuitive understanding of the subject. And yet that is precisely what I'm trying to aim for, something that is in your bones, something that you relate to in a way that is quantitative and precise, and yet that you carry with you in a compact form. All right, that is what I'm trying to focus on. Also, part of this is connections with other forms of physics and astrophysics. And this is what I'm also trying to convey. I will try to show you in the course of these lecture series that just about everything you care to think about in terms of astrophysics comes to bear on stellar dynamics. And therefore, this is definitely not a course in applied classical mechanics. All of astrophysics from cosmology all the way to stellar evolution will turn out to play a role in this lecture series. So, another thing that I need to say about the book, even though in the book the basic materials of this course are present, they are not present in the order that I prefer. I'm not going to read from the book, I'm not even going to follow the order of events, right? It's perfectly logical the way it is in the Binney and Tremaine book, and yet my preference is much more than what these authors do to start with the dynamics, with how things change, what the mechanism is behind stellar dynamics. Similarly, I will pay scant attention to the observations. I will show you basically just one observation today, and using that, I will try to explain to you how this particular subject hangs together in various ways. Then, having done that, I will try to give you a little overview over what it is in the book that is going to be used, right? And I will put a list of this on the web so that you can refer back to the various chapters. All right, are there any questions so far? Remarks, preferences? I mean, you know, one of the enormous advantages of having a small group of people like this and having a small subject, in numbers, as it were, as astrophysics, is that you can more or less, you know, guide things the way you want it to be. It's not like I'm teaching an introductory course for 200 students here, right? So if you have any preferences at all, any remarks.
Will the directions to the proper or the corresponding paragraphs in the book?
Yes, I will. Yeah. Let me think about how to do this. I think it's wise for me to... Okay. Let me first give you my introduction about how this connects with observations. And then I will, after the break, I'll bring the book here. I'll just simply read through the various points. I have made a list of paragraphs that will be treated. Okay. Every now and then I will sort of verbatim refer to that, but otherwise there's absolutely excellent index in the book and you can always find it back. I checked that. Any further questions, remarks, preferences, gripes, whatever? Cool. Okay. Let us then start on Let us then start on the subject proper. And I will do this, as is appropriate for a physical science, by talking about observations. However, I will do this in a very brief fashion, by giving you precisely one form of stellar system that I think will give you an impression as to what we're going to be talking about. I will be talking in particular about just one object, a globular cluster of stars, an object that contains something of the order of a million, give or take a few stars of various masses. And I will try in front of you to analyze this one picture, to give you an idea of what it is we're trying to explain and how it is that you can wrap your mind around this, okay, that you can almost see in front of you what it is that is going to be relevant for understanding this type of structure. I will be keeping referring to this throughout the lecture series, right, in order to give you the idea that this is precisely where the connections go with the rest of astrophysics and with some of the rest of physics. Insofar as the Binney and Tremaine book starts with a chapter on observations, I have a very strong recommendation for you. do take that first chapter, put it next to your computer, wherever you have access to the web, and really go through the pictures, right? It's just a black and white printed book with words and equations and very, very few good images. Now, there's terabytes of that good stuff on the web, and I want you to swim in it. I really want you to do it yourself on the web. Really do this, please, right? You will be doing yourself and science a great favor. Effectively, what I will be talking about is systems of this sort. This is the globular cluster Messier 80, and I want you to just take this in some detail, because already here in a single picture do we have effectively 90% of the subject that we have, will be going to be talking about. Or maybe it's fair to, since we were raising hands anyway for your various preferences and stuff, let me go through this point by point and then ask you after that if there are more things that you instantly notice on this particular image that we're trying to understand, that we're trying to explain. To begin with, you will see that this object is practically spherically symmetric. And you might think it's a projection effect, but there are so many of these things in the sky that just from statistics we can say that ellipticity is the exception for things like this. Right? In fact, there is only one notably elliptical globular cluster in the sky, Omega Centauri. And that is why a number of years ago a colleague and I wrote a paper about this, arguing that Omega Centauri was in fact a merger of two of these objects, which is something that we'll get to be talking about during these lectures. It's practically spherical. It's strongly centrally condensed. Of course, in a photograph like this, where the center's been completely overlapped by the various images, you do not really get a very good view of what is going on inside here. Quantitatively, I have been emphasizing already in my introduction, and I will keep emphasizing again and again, that having quantities in your head is a useful thing to do. Right? So instantly, I hope at least, when you see a picture like this, there is a little question forming just at the back of your amygdala or something thereabouts. What is actually the stellar density here? How many stars per cubic parsec? How many stars per cubic meter? How many kilograms per cubic meter? What's the number attached to this, right? In our solar neighborhood, as I think you are aware, your typical stellar density is approximately one solar mass type star per cubic parsec, or something of that general sort. Densities over here can easily be millions of times bigger, right? So that just simply says that this is truly a separate condensed object, as it were, in the universe, even though it consists of separate points, separate stars. Of course, you will quantitatively want to know how centrally condensed. Now, this is something that you can find on the web. This is something that you can find to a certain extent in the Binney and Tremaine book. But in any case, part of the aim of this series is already evident in here. We will need to explain why it is that if you were to take the stellar density in, let us say, solar masses per cubic parsec, from the center of this object outward, why it is that this density profile is a certain kind and not something different, and whether this is universal or whether this is specific for this particular object. Right, I already mentioned to you that your typical galaxy like ours has approximately 100-odd of these objects floating about, and therefore you can do some statistics on this. to see how centrally condensed, to just enlarge the central bit a little bit, that's just the factor 4 blow-up, and, well, this is not really quite resolved. Right? I have another one over here, Messier 15, which is much better resolved, and when you go to the center of this object over here, you see that. Now, instantly, your physics mind ought to say, is this really what there is? Is this image a true image in the sense that everything there is in this object or in that object or in that object that is seen? And naturally, this is not so. Right? you may well think that there are point objects in here, such as white dwarfs, neutron stars, maybe black holes, that do contribute to the overall structure, but you do not see in an image like this. I have deliberately taken only this optical image. It's a VB band image. But that is something that you need to think about straight away. Another thing that we will get to talk about later when we talk about the origin of binaries is this all there is to the extent that is this only stars in such an object? Maybe there is a certain amount of gas present here too that you maybe do not see on this particular image and that yet contributes to the structure and the evolution of this object. So already by just looking at one image, you have a number of questions, a number of research questions that will be relevant to trying to understand what this particular structure is and what this particular structure does. And this is an illustration of what I'm trying to reach with this kind of lecture series. Questions of this sort, when presented with these observations, are things that I very much would like you to generate yourself by the time you see it. What about this? What about that? What about that? What's behind this? What is the structure? What's the... This is only a time snapshot. But sort of, when you exercise your mind, you can already see it moving to a certain extent. How does it move? Oh, you're a master's course here. You all know about Kepler's laws and stuff of that general sort. Question that immediately on a snapshot like this should jump to the front in your head is, if I pick a particular star, such as this one over here, is it on an orbit like a planetary orbit around here? Is it on an orbit that plunges through the center over here? How does it move? Maybe some stars plunge through the center and some stars orbit around. What gives? This kind of thing already is present right in here. Now, although the dynamics in this case is frozen, we will see that the dynamics plays an essential role in understanding systems of this sort, which is why I will deviate a little bit from the Binney and Tremain book, and when going to the dynamics part, I will start by talking about the dynamical laws, the equations of motion, rather than the equations of structure. Of course, when trying to explain a structure like this, and we will do this in some detail, you can try to pretend that it is static, that it's just an average over a million stars. And yet, I would maintain, I will try to demonstrate why it is, that the dynamics is the alpha and the omega of this particular subject, and that an instantaneous snapshot like this may be very interesting, but is in a sense a superficial effect. You see that this thing is centrally condensed. And, of course, knowing physics, knowing astronomy from your bachelor's courses, you instantly think about the role of gravity in this case. So the presence of a gravitational attraction between all these various points over here is, in a sense, already implicit in this image. And that just like our sun is the biggest thing in our solar system, a clump of stars like this is the biggest thing in this globular cluster. By the way, talking about the biggest thing in a condensed structure, such as our solar system, you know perfectly well that the mass of our sun is 1,000 times bigger than the mass of all of the rest of the solar system together. Why is it then that an object like this does not have a single central object, a single monster star? Something that is 1,000 times more massive than all of the rest of this cluster taken together. And this illustrates one particular point that is dear to my mind, which I should like to emphasize to you right now. Already by looking at this image, you can discern an extremely important property of the stars that make up this system. Think about it. Usually, I phrase this in terms of why is the sky dark at night? Well, of course, the sun has set, which is not true because sunset is not existent anymore since we know the Earth rotates, but that's a pedantic remark that doesn't really matter. The sun is nearby and the stars are far away. But that is nonsense because suppose that I take the sun and put 1,000 times further away, it would look a million times fainter. But if the sun intrinsically would put out 10 million times more light than it right now does, it would still be 10 times brighter if I put it 1,000 times away than the sun in the daytime. The fact that it is dark at night means at least one thing. There is an upper limit to the intrinsic brightness of stars. If there weren't, a star could be practically infinitely far away, but if it's practically infinitely luminous, it would still outshine the sun, even at night. The fact that you do not have a single object in the center over here, even though gravity is stamped all over the place here, is due to the fact that if a star gets to be bigger than approximately 120 solar masses, its own radiation blows it up. And that is already present in this image over here. And that brings me to the second point. The second point is that you can already see the composition of this object over here. You see that some of the stars are blue, like this one over here, and that one over there, and that one over there. And there's many others that are red. And therefore, you see stellar evolution stamped on this, just as clearly as you see gravity stamped on this. Now, you might think that the colors of the stars, that they're indicators of their masses, of their status in stellar evolution, are not so very important. However, it definitely is. Because think about it. Why is it that this is not one enormous mess? Why is it that this system consists of individual points? Again, think about numbers. I mentioned a moment ago that the density of stars in these objects can easily be millions times bigger than the density of stars in our solar neighborhood. And yet, if you think about numbers, the star-to-star distance over there is still enormous as compared to the stellar size. Now, that brings me to my first numerical exercise. When seeing something like this, and one noticing from the stages of stellar evolution over here that this object is probably quite old, in fact, it may be billions of years old. You can already see this from the fact that you have all these giant stars, these red giant stars over here. Tells you that it must have been like this for quite a while. That also means that it must be exceedingly unlikely for stars to hit one another. Because if they do, we were talking about orbits earlier. Mind you that possibly this star's on a radial orbit like this, or maybe on a circular orbit. In any case, it will be moving among its friends. What is the probability that it will hit something? Well, the probability that you hit another star is given by 1 minus e to the power minus r over lambda. It's not too hard to derive this equation for the mean free path, but I will not do that right here. Lambda is the mean free path of a star. And lambda turns out to be equal to 1 divided by the number density, that is the number of points per unit volume, times the interception cross-section. So if you have a star like our sun, which is a nice sphere and all that, it is this circle. See, it gives a surface sigma over here. What I'd like you to do is to compute, I mean numerically, what the mean free path is under these circumstances. I already mentioned that the typical density of stars in the solar neighborhood is of the order of 1 star per cubic parsec. You know what the surface is of a star like our sun, so you can easily compute what the mean free path is. Right? We'll talk about ages later. Already in your mind, when I give you a length, a time scale should be jumping to the front. Because if we're talking about the possible motion of stars in here, when we talk about the motion of stars and a path length, a mean free path, that of course also gives you a time scale. You know what the speed is, you know what the mean free path is, so you can tell how long it takes before a star hits another one. I mean physically hits one, bang, smack on, okay? We'll be coming back to this in the case of stellar dynamics quite a few times. So I commend this particular expression to your attention. I'll be coming back to that later in some detail. Now, seeing all this then tells you a lot about what it is that we're going to have to do if we want to understand structures of this type. And as I have already mentioned, I take this as emblematic. Okay? I take this as something that is a typical example of a quasi-isolated stellar system. What I have said, however, transports straight away to other stellar systems, such as dwarf galaxies, ordinary galaxies, and so on and so forth. However, globular clusters have always been quite central to the subject of stellar dynamics for various reasons, the most important one being that they are so isolated and they contain no further, interfering elements, such as large quantities of gas. Right? If you have a galaxy like our own Milky Way containing like 10% of its mass or 15% of its mass in the form of gas or something like that, then you will understand that that can be having an important effect on this, including things like the formation of new stars. And this is not what is going on here. This is a purely nice and isolated system, which is why it is emblematic of the subject of stellar dynamics. What I've tried to do here is, guided by a single image, or at least a number of images such as this one and this one over here, demonstrate to you how it is that your various research questions frame themselves, how it is that what we have to explain and what we will try to understand in this lecture series comes to the fore just simply by looking at it. That is, the fact that you talk about an n-body system, or n in this case is something like over a million or something thereabouts, that we talk about a, for practical purposes, collisionless n-body system, because it will turn out when you compute the numbers here that this mean free path, even for the stellar density in the center of a globular cluster, is truly enormous, and that it, you can fairly say that a physical hit of one star on another one during the lifetime of an object like this is extremely improbable. Now, looking at this then, you see that the system is relaxed. It looks as if this is a nice, quiet, even distribution. It's nicely spherical, it is centrally condensed, there's nothing really truly dramatic about it. Question that should jump to your head is, well, that may be fair enough, but you only have a snapshot here. Maybe the spatial distribution of the stars here looks relaxed, but maybe the velocity distribution does not. You don't see the velocities here. It's a snapshot. Well, then the counter-argument would be, but you would have to sort of look at the numbers in that case, is if velocities here were really very strange things, if, for instance, half the stars would be rotating this way and the other half of the stars would be rotating this way, or half the stars would be in radial orbits and the other half would be in circular orbits, a system like this would not retain its shape very long. And then by looking at the population of globules, you can say, no. If the spatial shape is this symmetric, it is quite likely that the velocity structure is quite symmetric also, right? So looking at this, you know what the task ahead is. We will have to construct not only the orbits of the various individual points, but the collective of them. And that brings me to the final point that you can see in front of your eyes here. A system like this has to a certain extent to be self-consistent. Think about it. If you look at our solar system, what you typically do is do a very, very good first approximation. You consider a planetary orbit as totally dominated by the sun, and the rest of the universe is an interesting. And we know this with Kepler's laws and things like that about elliptical orbits and orbits in a plane, blah, 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 all that good stuff. In a stellar system, there is no single dominant mass. As already mentioned to you a moment ago, this cannot be, because a star more massive than 120-odd solar masses blows itself up by its own radiation, the so-called Eddington limit. And therefore, A system like this is not like a gravitational dictatorship, like a solar system, but it's a gravitational democracy. Everybody has approximately the same say in the affairs of the entire system. You have a question?
So it cannot be a very massive star, but why isn't it a black hole?
Excellent question. I'm going to answer your question straight away by jumping ahead a little bit. Very good. Yes, it could definitely be that in the course of the stellar evolution that has taken place in this cluster, a number of black holes formed. Almost certainly there have been in the initial phases of the stellar cluster. When looking at this, I think you can already show by looking, understand just by looking at it, that there aren't really any supermassive stars in here anymore. Right? You don't see them. You don't see a number of dominant blue stars here. You don't see supernova remnants. You see nothing of the sort. However, it is plausible, it's not a proof, but it is plausible that in the initial phases of the formation of an object like this, there were, in fact, massive stars around. And we know that a certain fraction of those massive stars, in particular in binaries and things, end up as black holes. Now, it's then perfectly possible for a black hole to be lurking in here somewhere and to have little by little gobbled up some of the other stars of the cluster. The reason that at first you would not think that this is an important effect is already written on the blackboard over here. If you were to compute the mean free path of a star in a cluster like this, and for this cross-section you used either the Schwarzschild surface or you use the surface of a star, you end up with a mean free path that is still totally enormous. If then you have an idea about the velocity of the stars, we get to be talking about that in an instant, you will find that the total time a star could have crisscrossed this object over here without having been eaten by the black hole, all right, is really enormous, much bigger than the lifetime of the universe. Consequently, at least in the state that this object is right now, the way we see it in this observation, the growth rate of any black stellar mass black hole in it is negligible, right? And therefore, it could not possibly have grown to the size that it would dynamically dominate the entire cluster. However, your question is very relevant because this could have happened earlier, right? When these numbers here, this mean free path, is very, very different. Let us imagine, for example, that in the initial stages of the formation of such a stellar system, a number of stellar mass black holes, shall we say 50, 60, 100 solar masses or something, formed. That was, as I had already mentioned, in a phase when massive stars formed in a very early history of this object. Because by now, those massive stars have already blown up. You don't see them anymore. At that time, however, the gas content of this system must have been very much bigger than it is today, because those stars must form from something. Gas clouds and stuff of that sort. Those gas clouds typically are very, very much bigger, as you're perfectly well aware, than their stars. If you want an impression as to how big the gas cloud is from which a star, like, for instance, our sun formed, you can think back and say, now, wait a minute, I know that outside Pluto's orbit, there's the Kuiper belt, and so on and so forth. That must have been at least the extent of the original cloud from which our solar system formed. Redo the number here. Don't compute the interception cross-section for the surface of a star, but take for this interception cross-section the radius of the Kuiper belt, okay, something like 50, 60, 100 astronomical units or thereabout. You get a drastically different number. So it is perfectly possible that then, in the very early phases of such an object, a supermassive black hole might have formed in here. I'm skipping ahead all the way to the end of the course here. In order to get an answer to your a quantitative answer to your question, does this or does this not happen, right? It seems very unlikely from what we now know about the formation and the structure of this particular object here, low, quote unquote, low mass, as masses cosmically go, a million solar masses or so, had not yet been able to form a supermassive black hole in its center. However, multiply this object over here in numbers by a factor of something like 100,000 or thereabouts. And you will end up with the center of an elliptical galaxy, which is also something that we will get to consider in this lecture series. The centers of elliptical galaxies are completely dominated by supermassive black holes. So apparently, the stellar dynamics depends not only on time, on mass and gravity, but also on the total number of objects involved. Because otherwise, there would be no reason why this thing has no supermassive black hole in the center, at least compared with the mass of the thing as it is. An elliptical galaxy does, right? And all these things you can already sort of, I would almost say, intuit, even without having written down a single equation, with except the exception of this totally straightforward mean free path equation over here. But I do recommend do the numbers. Let's track back a little bit. As already mentioned, this object does look very relaxed. Right? And the question we now have to ask ourselves, how could that possibly have been the case? In order to understand that, we must take an extra step and think a little bit more about what it is that even a picture like this can tell us about the dynamics.